She puts them to work, setting the table as Mary Margaret leans against the wall watching. "When is Jimmy coming back?" she says. She rubs her hand through her tight blue curls.
"He's never coming back," Amy says. "He said so."
"Amy!"
"What?"
Mary Margaret says. "He's coming back," Ellen says. "He just went out for a bit. He's at the Gander with Hummer and Bill." And as soon as she says it, she knows it's the only place he would go. Back to his high school friends, to the booth where they always sat, squashed between the jukebox and the restrooms. "He said he'll be home on time to go to midnight mass."
"He said he never wants to see any of us again."
"No, he didn't," Herbert says.
Mary Margaret looks back and forth among all of them. Amy's eyes are bright. "Believe who you like," Ellen says. "Food's ready." They sit down to Christmas dinner. The goose is dry as bread. Mary Margaret shakes her head at the first bite, makes a clicking sound with her tongue.
"Mama made goose so it fell off the bone," she says.
Ellen puts the kids to bed early, sets their alarm for 11. There on Amy's bed is a star she made out of cardboard and glitter. So it was Fritz who threw their decorations away. Mary Margaret would have saved nothing unless it belonged to Herbert.
"It's a good star," Herbert says.
"Like me," Ellen thinks, "trying to fix things, trying to make it all better." And Amy, like James, who will be comforted by no one, crumples it into a ball that unfolds bit by bit after she throws it into the trash. It rustles there like a living thing as she turns away to get into her nightgown. Herbert dresses standing beside Ellen, his body gray, hollows in the lamplight. Mary Margaret stops outside the doorway.
"Come watch me take my pills," she says.
"In a minute," Ellen says. "We're saying prayers." She waits until she hears Mary Margaret move down the hall and the bathroom door click shut behind her. The children get into their beds and stare at the ceiling. "Angel of God," Ellen prompts them, and they continue with her. "My guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here, ever this night be at my side, to light and guard, to rule and guide. Amen." Their voices chanting together are like music in the half-dark, and when they finish, they are quiet for a moment. The prayer itself means little to Ellen. It's the sound of the words, the feeling of so many people before her who spoke them with the same sadness, the same need. She said this prayer every night as a child, tucked into her mother's bed. When the light clicked off, bleeding into the darkness, she was comforted by the thought of God watching over her. Prayers were a charm against loneliness. Prayers were an incantation warding off the razor-toothed fears that slept just out of sight, a constant humming presence. In the morning there would be prayers before getting out of bed, prayers before and after meals, prayers for special intentions. On Sunday mornings, Mom drove them all to Mass. On Saturday evenings, they said the rosary, kneeling shoulder to shoulder on the living room rug. Even now, Ellen can hear their individual voices, Heidi's light soprano, Gert's reedy whisper. "Daddy is coming back," she says to Amy. "You know that, don't you?"
"I don't want him to come back."
The spell of the prayer is broken. "Get some rest," Ellen says. "You don't want to fall asleep during Mass."
"I don't want him to come back either," Herbert says, but he is sleeping,
his mouth closing around Amy's words, repeating them like a lullaby. Ellen kisses them goodnight, then goes to find Mary Margaret in the bathroom. She's dressed for bed in her pink gown with the billowy sleeves. Her breath smells of goose. "Aren't you going to midnight mass?" Ellen says.
3, 4,
she's measuring out her pills. She swallows them with water, coughs briefly. Then she bends her head forward and Ellen squeezes Ben Gay into her hands, rubs her neck, her smooth shoulders beneath the gown. Mary Margaret's skin is the softness of peach skin, the softness of babies and satin and water, the softness of rot. "What about Mass?"
"I don't want to go without Jimmy,"
Mary Margaret says. She gets up, pulling Ellen's hands with her under the gown, shrugs them away, and goes down the hall into her room. Ellen washes her hands, scrubs them with a washcloth to take off the greasy residue. When she comes out of the bathroom, she turns on all the living room lights, the lamp, the overhead light, the light above the TV. She goes into the kitchen and turns on the oven light, the big light over the counter, and she switches on the glass chandelier in the dining room. She bumps the heat up from 60 to 85. Wasting electric, wasting oil. She eats fingerfuls of cold stuffing from the dish in the refrigerator. Soon it is all gone, and so is leftover pumpkin pie. Still, she is hungry. She is raging with hunger. She takes the plate of pfeffernusse into the living room and turns on the TV, a Christmas special about an elf who cannot make toys. The first TV she ever saw belonged to her mother's sister and her family. They watched the Howdy Doody show, and while the picture filled the tiny screen, she and her cousins and sisters were silent, frozen, not wanting to blink or swallow or cough and accidentally miss a moment of that magic. Afterward, Aunt Amelia was impressed, not so much with the TV as with the quietness of the children. TV was a wonderful thing, she said, because TV made children behave. Even now, staring at the screen, Ellen feels her hunger melt into a dull ache she can easily ignore. What will happen to the elf? Why can't he learn to make toys? At 10, the show is over and she wraps the gifts. A portable radio for James, chocolate lemon creams for Fritz and Mary Margaret. She bought the kids mostly clothes this year, boots for Amy, a down vest for Herbert, socks and underwear and lined mittens. Then, on a whim, she bought each of them a large stuffed mouse, one orange, one blue. Now she realizes they will both want either the orange one or the blue one. They will fight, they will cry. Someone will be unhappy. She wraps the mice, leaving only their long tails sticking out. Since there is no Christmas tree, she arranges the gifts around the TV, spreading them out so they'll look like more. Then she sits on the couch and stares at the reflection of herself in the window. Her skin is the color of pale bread. Her eyes and nostrils are hollows. Her short, permed hair is uneven, curly in patches, straight above her forehead. She looks like any woman she might see in the grocery store. When she was about Amy's age, she invented her future self from pictures she cut from the Sears catalog. Her future self wore aqua shoes and hose and an aqua dress. Her hair was blonde, swept up in the back, full in front. Perfect hair, perfect body, perfect clothes. She had 8 children, and each of them had beautiful names. Veronica, Evelyn, Ruth. Her husband was sophisticated, dignified, certainly not someone who sold farm equipment. He worked in an office. Her aqua body greeted him at the door after work each day. Her aqua arms hung up his coat, led him to a table filled with delicious things to eat. The children sat each in their place, and she turned to smile at them one by one. "This is what my future self looks like," Ellen tells her reflection. "This is what a real wife and mother looks like." But she sees her aqua self shimmering behind her own reflection in the glass. It is almost 11 o'clock, and James has not come home. Her aqua self smiles her satisfied, perfect smile, the smile Ellen had chosen after scanning page after page, clipping many figures of women who weren't quite right. But now the smile gives Ellen a chill. There is something behind it, something desperate, something terrifying. She jumps up and goes into the children's room, turns off their alarm clock. Then she puts on her boots and her own thin winter coat. If she walks fast, she can make it downtown in 15 minutes, grab James from the gander, swing back for the kids, and get to church early enough to listen to the choir. For a moment, standing in the entryway, she smells the Aqua Lady's sweet, sweet perfume. Stay home with the children. Wait for James. When he comes home, be gracious. Tell him it's all right. She leaves at a run with James's key in her pocket. Behind her, all the lights blaze in the house like fire. She finds the car parked outside the gander with its headlights on. The doors are locked. She doesn't have a key. The light from the headlights is a watery yellow against the snow. Cars and trucks are parked randomly along the street, facing each other, facing away from each other. Hummer's rusted Mustang has one wheel lodged on the sidewalk as if it is pulling itself toward the warmth and lights and smells of the bar, which have filtered out into the cold air of the street. Her lungs ache from running. She pushes her way into the bar, through the men standing by the door. One of them grabs her sleeve. When she shoves him away, there is laughter. Ellen has always hated bars, the smoke, the noise, the groups of half-drunk men who always laugh in the same sly way. Before she married James, she sometimes went to bars with her girlfriends, but she always sat with her back to the wall, unable to feel safe. Marriage, she thought, would be shelter from all that. From men who look at you and laugh that way because you belong to no one. yet marriage brought its own brand of laughter. On her wedding day, Hummer kissed her full on the lips.
"Warming her up for you, Jimmy," he'd said,
and the other men whistled when she slapped his face. She spots James in his usual booth with Bill and Hummer and a woman she doesn't know. The woman is Ellen's age, but only another woman would guess it. To men, she would look younger, with her stylish hair and painted nails, her sneakers with jingle bells tied up in the laces. She wears a cute red Santa's cap, and Ellen hates her for it. As she watches, the woman leans over, puts her tongue in Hummer's ear. James is sitting beside Bill, his head propped up on one hand, his skinny legs crossed at the ankles. He turns, looks at Ellen, but does not notice she is there, and she thinks wildly that perhaps it isn't him, that she's made a mistake, and he's home right now, wondering where she is. Somebody touches her arm, and she jerks it away, spins around. "Oh, I'm sorry," she says quickly. "It's one of the fourth-grade teachers from school." Ellen promptly forgets her name. It's Beatrice, maybe, or Carol.
"I always pegged you as the quiet type, and here you are on Christmas Eve. Looks can be deceiving."
The woman grins. Then she looks at Ellen closely.
"Hey, it's me, Barb. You okay?"
"No," Ellen says. Then Hummer sees her, waves his arm.
"Ellie!" he shrieks. He has a high, wandering voice, mocking. "Merry Christmas," he says. "Come and have a drink."
"Is that your husband?" Barb says. "The one to the left," Ellen says grimly. "The one with his head on the table."
"Wow," Barb says, staring at James. "He's going to have one hell of a stiff neck."
"He's going to have more than that," Ellen says. And Barb laughs, but kindly, and squeezes her arm before disappearing into the crowd. Ellen sidesteps a group of slow-dancing couples, sits down next to James. 5 people in a booth is tight, but she doesn't want anyone to be comfortable. James lifts his head and drapes a heavy arm around her shoulders. A half-empty pitcher is on the table, certainly not the first.
"Whoops," James says. "I was going to get back for midnight mass."
The beer has wiped his expression clean. There's no trace of Fritz, the children, Christmas. No trace of her. Only his nose looks different, puffy with traces of blood at the corner of one nostril. A few stained tissues are crumpled on the table in front of him. Hummer checks his watch. It is gold, large, too big for his wrist.
"Ah, shit, me too," he says sarcastically.
"You Catholic?" he asks the woman.
"Used to be," she says. She takes a large swallow of beer. "Fuck that shit."
"That's sacrilege," James whispers to Ellen, truly amazed. "Did you hear what she just said?"
"I ain't been to Mass in years," Bill says. "I always mean to go, but then..."
He smiles, shrugs, drinks his beer. "Hey, Ellen, you going?"
"If the car starts," she says.
James looks at her strangely. "You left the lights on," she says. "Give me the key. I'm going to try and start it."
"Okay, okay," James says. "Okay, okay, 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 okay."
His hands work through his pockets like hands moving underwater. When she grabs the keys, the woman snickers.
"Looks like Jimmy's in trouble," she says, and she shakes her jingle bell feet.
"Have a Merry Christmas," Ellen says, and she leaves them to their beer. As she's struggling past the men around the door, her heel finds a toe, grinds hard, and then she's back on the street. She unlocks the car, gets in, turns it over. Nothing. She doesn't bother to try again. She puts her head on the steering wheel, thinking about the long walk home, the kids waking up in the morning to the presents strewn around the TV. The thud of the music from inside the gander is as muffled as a heartbeat. Snow falls, peaceful as the snow in a movie or a song. Silent night, holy night. It's a beautiful Christmas Eve. In the morning, the fields around her mother's house will be like a single cloth spread across a wide table, the pine trees shuddering with chickadees and juncos, the smell of wood smoke in the air. She thinks about how she will have to pretend to her mother, to her sisters. "Yes, what a wonderful Christmas we had. How was yours?" And her voice will be the voice of the Aqua Lady, charming and sweet and unreal. A lady's voice. The voice she chose for herself when she was just a little girl. Lullaby. Their hands remind him of skeleton hands. Their eyes, the round, blank eyes of ghosts,
As a boy, he'd been afraid of Halloween. The neighborhood children carved tiny jack-o'-lanterns and carried them, leering and lit, from farm to farm. From the window of the bedroom he shared with his brother, he could see strings of jack-o'-lantern smiles gliding through the dark fields. Sometimes one of the smiles broke from the others, arced wildly, twisting as it fell, burst into blackness. Later, much later, his brother would come home smelling of crushed pumpkin rot. He'd climb into James's bed and sit on James's stomach and pinch his nipples hard, saying, "Chicken, chicken, chicken." James swallows, licks his lips. What kind of man looks at his own children and thinks of Halloween? They are waiting for him in their beds. Pale fingers, thin and reaching, their pointed chins remind him of witches. They are waiting to press their cool witch lips to his neck. They are waiting to breathe candy kisses into his ears. They are waiting for him to tuck them in because he said he would do it. James stands in the doorway, not wanting to come in, not wanting those skeleton fingers even accidentally touching his own. He has never tucked them in before. He wants to be closer to his children. "Have you said your prayers?" he asks. If he stands just so, his feet wide apart, his back straight, both his shoulders brush the doorframe. He feels he is standing the way a father should, upright, firm, filling in the extra space. A lamp glows on the nightstand between the beds, and the shade of the lamp is painted with angels, white-winged angels in long, pale gowns. "Yes," Bert says. "No," Amy says. She has a bruise on her cheek. The shape reminds James of a lemon and makes his mouth taste sour. Amy says importantly, "Do you know what you're supposed to do?" He wonders how she got the bruise. Little girls, he knows, get bruises now, just the way little boys used to. "You pull up the covers and ask us, do the pillows feel okay? And if we say no, you say, 'Oops, must be a stone in here somewhere,' and you take the pillow and scrunch it and shake it and give it back. Then you say prayers and you kiss us goodnight." She is such a plain little girl. His mother, he knows, doesn't like her. It isn't fair to dislike a little girl just because she is plain. "That's what Mom does," she says. Sunken cheeks. She does not have her brother's looks. Bert is small and sweet as an elf, except for the pointed incisors, too big for his mouth, which peep from the edges of his lips like fangs. He looks shockingly like James did at that age, delicate, pretty, mistaken sometimes for a girl. His eyes glitter. He is staring at James. He's always staring at James. He wants James to... what? James looks again at Amy's bruise, swallows the sour taste. Bert's arms are wrapped tight around a large blue mouse, an orange one like it squats at the foot of Amy's bed. To James, both mice are gray. He is colorblind. But Ellen told him the colors, which he memorized, because he's making an effort, because he wants to be close to the children. "What a nice blue mouse," he says. He remembers something his grandmother used to sing to make children fall asleep. Her name was Anne, and she had long hair which she wore in braids and a bump on her chin where sharp black whiskers grew. When she died, they laid her on the kitchen table to prepare her body to be put into the ground where God would take it away. Once, when no one else was in the house, he lay flat on the table to see what it felt like to be dead. It was summer. Flies buzzed against the windows, and a faint breeze smoothed his hair. He waited until he heard the flutter of angels' wings and smelled the sweet vanilla odor of their breath. "Braun Kuh, Schwarze Kuh, mach die Augen zu." James sings to the children in a quavery woman's voice. His mother caught him there, stretched across the cold, hard wood, and he was punished. He knows he was punished, but can't remember how. It was one of the few times his mother ever punished him. He was the delicate one, sickly, just like she was. Hassenfuss, Mitch called him. Mama's boy. The children look at him with their blank, ghost eyes. Braun Kuh, Schwarze Kuh. How does it go? Those black whiskers poking his cheek, the smell of grease in her hair. "Daddy, what does that mean?" Bert says. Round eyes glitter. "It means," James says, "brown cow, black cow." He waits for the words to come.
Make your eyes shut. They think about that. Their cool witch lips form silent shapes, singing. Her braids twisted together, pinned high on her head, a nest of hair smelling of grease. She stabs metal forks into the apples one by one, then swirls them in caramel, lines them up on a platter.
When they come to the door, you give them these, she says.
And he waits, shivering in the drafty entryway, the jack-o'-lanterns drifting toward him, as though he is the center, the core, the magnet, his brother's brightest smile in the lead. During the night, he gets up, restless, untangling his breathing from Ellen's moist, deep breaths, leaving the stale cloud of warmth beneath the blankets. It is after midnight. He has been dreaming about the children. They clung to him as the air swarmed with bees. It was the sound of the bees that woke him, the shrill scream of a thousand wings blending into song. Braunkuh, Schwarzkuh. He cannot remember the rest. His brother would have known. Mitch was older. He remembered everything, anything, when he wanted to. A mind like a steel trap, his mother said. Mitch was the smart one, good in school, while James was held back because he couldn't learn his colors, because he stuttered when he spoke, head down, voice almost too soft to hear. Skinny James, always frail like his mother, always with a black eye or a bruised rib or an arm in a sling, accident-prone, careless. But James is alive and Mitch is dead. Mitch died when the truck he was driving overturned, rolled deep into a culvert, burst into flames. Now he is buried at St. Michael's Cemetery, asleep in the ground like the twin brothers James can barely remember. They lived less than an hour, not long enough to seem real, and his mother and grandmother denied that they had ever been born. But Mitch showed James what their mother said were two dogs' graves on the gentle swell of land overlooking the house. James liked to stand on their flat granite stones, each the size of a man's footprint, his legs spread wide as they could go, swinging his arms for balance. Once, Mitch gave him a shove, and James pitched forward into his knees, embarrassed in front of his little brothers, who he knew must be laughing, like Mitch, at his clumsiness, their baby mouths black with dirt. The thought of them churned in his stomach, and he wouldn't visit their graves after that. Together down there, whispering secrets. Even now, small children make James nervous. Smooth faces, blank ghost eyes, tiny fingers and toes. He never knows what they are thinking. Their faces are masks, their expressions wiped clean of words. The slightest thing can kill them, a cold, a bump, a bruise. Then they close their eyes and disappear into the ground. He gropes his way down the dark hall, past the children's bedroom, past his parents' bedroom. In the living room, he turns on the TV and sits down on the couch. The light from the TV fills the air like mist. His head is still thick with a dream. Amy's chin hooked over his shoulder, Bert's legs wrapped like a belt around his waist, the strange costume of their bodies against his own. The show is an old 60s movie, and he folds himself eagerly into the plot. A man and a woman have married. In a quiet room, they kiss. The woman's head thrown back to expose her throat, the man's face impassive. They are just starting out. They call each other honey and dear. When the man wants to go out for a paper, he does it. When the woman wants to take a nap, she lies down. They are not being watched by tiny masked faces. They do not think of bruises in the shape of lemons. They are not forced to recall lullabies that make them remember other bitter things. When a commercial interrupts, James watches that too. He loves TV more than anything he can think of. It is small and neat. It is easy to understand. Wives love their husbands. Children love their fathers. Brothers love their brothers. In real life, he is away from home for weeks at a time, traveling state to state, selling farm machinery. When he comes back, Ellen's clothing has spilled over into his dresser drawers. The children do their homework at his desk by the phone. He doesn't know where to sit at the table, beside his mother like he used to, or next to Ellen, his wife. He doesn't know which hanger to use to hang his coat. One of the stuffed gardenia-scented ones, a wire one, cedar. And then the children, the smooth skin of their foreheads, so delicate, so uncertain. Kiss Daddy hello, they must be told. He hates the wet bite of their lips. He hates setting down his luggage, crouching, swooping them into his arms. And Ellen, wearing clothes he doesn't remember, using words he doesn't know. Remember the time we... she says. He does not. The distance between them grows like a shadow at the end of a long, hard day. Before they were married, they spent the night together in his car. The weather had turned bad, the roads swallowed in ice. They pulled into a ditch to wait it out and were buried together in the snow, forever close, forever sharing secrets. It was April 1959, and they married 1 month later, in May, the first buds just starting to show, and everyone eyeing Ellen's flat stomach and the whispers. All night they were together in his car. She looks at him now as if he were an appliance she doesn't think can be fixed. She wants to move away from Vinegar Hill and into a house of their own, a house where everything will be even more different, and he will feel even more out of place. The children are growing up, she says. Soon you won't know them anymore. Soon they won't know you. That's right, he says. That's good. But of course he doesn't really say it. It would be a terrible thing to say. And it isn't always true. Sometimes he feels his mind swallow him whole, the way a snake swallows a plain white egg, and inside the belly of his mind he is not afraid of his children. They come to him, soft as deer. Daddy, look, they say, showing him this, showing him that. And he always knows what to say without Ellen there to coach him. Talk to them, she says. Say something. But what? He finished his last trip ahead of schedule and came home 2 nights early, just as Ellen and the children were sitting down for supper. The table looked different to him, smaller, and he realized that the center leaf was missing. The children were in their pajamas. Ellen had flour in her hair. "Where's Ma and Pa?" he said. "At Senior Citizens," Ellen told him too brightly. "Kids, squish over for Daddy." She got a plate from the kitchen and filled it with chicken and dumplings. The children slowly edged toward Ellen's chair, leaving a small space for James between the table and the wall. "I don't like chicken and dumplings," he said. "I know that," Ellen said. She did not look at him as she set the plate down hard. "We weren't expecting you." "We love chicken and dumplings," Amy said. Herbert nodded, his cheeks bulging. "I thought you didn't like them," James said. "Just because you don't like something doesn't mean we have to feel the same way," Ellen said. And the children lifted their pointed chins, a gesture of Ellen's he vaguely recognized. After supper, she played with them in the living room, hauling them up by the feet into handstands and letting go. Their spindly bodies collapsed, knitted together, jumped up for more. "Me next! Me next!" they squealed. Each time a child crashed to the floor, James imagined a splintered bone. Their faces turned red, their hair swung in their eyes, their shirts fell down to expose soft, puckered bellies. "Careful!" he shouted, as Amy tipped over backward. "No more of this roughhousing!" Ellen crouched, put her head to the floor, and pushed her body upward, uncoiling into a perfect, pointy-toed handstand. Her hips tilted slightly, keeping balance. Her breasts and belly flattened into one sleek line. James stared at her, shocked, for he realized she was angry. That night, when he got into bed, she rolled as far away from him as she could. "I will not live with a stranger," she said, so quietly he almost couldn't hear. This time, when he came home, he told her, "I'll put them to bed tonight." But he stood in the doorway. He did not know what to say. He did not kiss them goodnight. He did not want to touch them. Hassenfuss, Mama's boy. "All set?" she asked when she came into the bedroom. "Yes." "How did it go?" "I sang a lullaby." "Did you kiss them goodnight?" When he didn't answer, she got out of bed, pulling both quilts along with her. "Ellie," he said, but she disappeared down the hall toward the children's room. For a while he lay shivering beneath the sheet, wondering what he should do. Then he got up to find a spare blanket. He looked in the chest of drawers and in the closet. He even bent to look under the bed. Finally he called to Ellen through the wall softly, not wanting to wake the children or his parents, but she didn't answer. So he put on his robe and lay back down, remembering how they had huddled together for warmth, the old Chevy swaddled in white, and how nothing wrong happened between them, although after that it was obvious they had to get married. What else could they do? The TV flickers in the misty darkness. James's head sinks to his chin. "You're their father," she said. Why would he dream of bees? "They love you," she said. He cannot remember the end of the song. Mitch would know, but Mitch is dead. He is buried in St. Michael's Cemetery, asleep in the ground like the twin brothers that died. He had a mind like a steel trap, but James cannot remember anything. He swallows, licks his lips. Without their faces before him, he cannot even remember what the children look like. Eyes, fingers, sunken cheeks, jack-o'-lantern smiles. What kind of man cannot remember his own children? The commercial ends. The lovers reappear. The woman twirls before the man, an angel in a long, pale gown. In the morning, he pretends to sleep as Ellen moves around the room, dressing for work in the semi-darkness. She steps into one of her teacher dresses, brown or blue, he cannot tell, that buttons up the front. A wide plastic belt cinches her waist. Her lips are outlined in lipstick. Her short hair is curled tight, sprayed close to her head. He can see everything without opening his eyes. When her lips touch his cheek, he has felt it coming and does not wince, does not react to her sigh. He would stay in this bed all day if he could stand it, his head half buried in his stiff, musty pillow, the blankets pulled up to his neck, bunched under his chin. But if he lies awake for long, his mind will wander and he'll find himself stretched out on hard, cool pine, hearing the buzz of flies and the beating of wings, the smell of vanilla, his mother's fierce scream. He opens his eyes. In the kitchen, Ellen says something sharp to the children. One of them answers back. "Wait." No one answered back in his grandmother's kitchen. Children were to be seen and not heard. He ate whatever was set before him. If he didn't clean his plate, it meant he must be ill, and his grandmother gave him tablespoons of cod liver oil. He remembers the oily taste, its slow, thick descent into his belly. His grandmother always watched him for signs of illness because his lungs were weak. In winter, he caught colds that lingered on for months. Feverish, he'd lie in bed, staring at the blankets his mother hung over the windows because light was dangerous to sick people. He tried not to fall asleep because he believed that was when people died. Plates clatter, jackets rattle, quick footsteps brush the floor. James struggles not to listen, but it's too late. He's awake now, and the day stretching out in front of him like a field of snow, the distant fence posts, frail as shadows, unable to contain him. The front door slams. James is relieved. Now he hears Fritz rumble, Mary Margaret moan. There are footsteps in the hall, the sound of the shower kicking in, once, twice. Mary Margaret scratches at the door and pokes her head into the room. He can smell the salve she rubs into her joints. "Jimmy," she says, "are you sick?" "No, Mother, I'm resting." "He wants us to play cards at Senior Citizens." She means Fritz. "Good, Mother," James says. "Go." "I could stay home if you wanted. You can ask him." "No, Mother," James says. "I just need to rest." He closes his eyes, waits until he hears the click of the door. The way she fusses over him makes him feel unmanly. It embarrasses him to think that he came from inside her body, his face pushing out through her woman's parts, his mouth clamped to her woman's nipple. It is only after they leave for Senior Citizens that James finally gets up, moving slowly down the hall to the bathroom as if he were floating there. He has one more day at home before he goes back on the road, this time a familiar route near Rochester, driving fast in the company car, stopping to eat at diners with names like Sal's and the Eggery and Dewdrop Inn. He no longer notices the flat land twisting into hills along the Mississippi, doesn't taste the bacon and hash and toast gleaming with oil. His mind swallows him whole, and he lives in its belly for days. It's the driving that does it, and the lull of the road, and the steadiness of the engine like a heartbeat. He shakes men's hands, smiles briefly at waitresses in coffee shops, but he is cocooned, invisible, serene. Returning home is being torn from all that. Returning home is waking up at 4:30 on a winter morning, his grandmother's hand in his hair, and breaking ice in the basin to wash his face and neck. They milked 36 cows between them, James, Mitch, and Fritz, while Anne got breakfast in the house and Mary Margaret sat wrapped in a shawl by the stove, sickly like James, never much help. He brushes his teeth, shaves, steps into the shower, feeling as though he is not actually doing any of these things, but is watching himself, or someone like himself, from a window that's too small for him to see the entire picture. He has had that feeling before. It is how he imagines a dead person feels. Once when he was 8 or 9, Mitch invented a game called Dead. He took James out to the barn, to one of the small rooms under the haymow where the bins of grain were stored. It was August. There had been no rain for weeks, but today the air felt different, moist, hot, waiting. Thunder rolled in the distance, but it was a hollow, meaningless sound. Mitch pulled a candle from his pocket, lit it, and used the hot wax drippings to fix it to a board. "Take off your clothes," Mitch said. "When you're dead, your clothes are the first things to rot." Bits of hay stuck to James's arms and legs. He could smell Mitch's sweat, bitter like onions. As he took off his clothes, it was as if he were watching another boy slip out of his shorts and T-shirt, fold them in half, place them gently on the floor. Mitch tied this other boy's wrists and ankles with rope. He blindfolded him with a sock that was still warm. "Dead people can't move," Mitch said. "Dead people can't speak or hear." And he pushed the other sock into the boy's mouth and stuffed warm wax into his ears. He lifted the boy into one of the bins of grain and covered his feet and legs, his crotch and belly, his chest and shoulders. James heard the beating of the boy's heart, the sound of his breath rushing through his wide nostrils. And then James, too, couldn't breathe, couldn't scream, couldn't pray. The soap is shaped like a heart, rose-scented, stingy in his eyes. The water drums his skull and he opens his eyes into the stream, trying to flush out the soap, the smell of roses too strong, too sharp, ever to be mistaken for real ones. There were real roses at Mitch's funeral, and they were no more fragrant than ice. Now James is alive to remember their odor, and it is Mitch who remembers nothing. It is Mitch who is dead. His casket was kept closed, the wooden lid covered with roses. They said there wasn't enough of Mitch left to recognize him anyway. Mitch, the handsome one, muscles like stones in his upper arms, thighs thick as James's waist. Mitch would have found a way to open the coffin to see if that really was his brother in there. But James was afraid. And now he'll never know. He'll never be absolutely sure. Sometimes he feels Mitch's hand hard on his shoulder. Sometimes he sees Mitch staring at him out of a stranger's eyes. Hands the size of platters, mind like a steel trap. When James gets out of the shower, the mirror is steamed the color of milk. He stares into it, sees nothing, feels nothing. Fritz and Mary Margaret are at Senior Citizens playing pinochle, sheep's head, rummy. Mitch is dead, and Ellen at work, and the children safely in school. The day stretches out like a field of snow. For lunch, James eats sausage on buttered bread, reading the newspaper in the living room. Last night, a Milwaukee man came home from work and shot his wife, their two children, the dog, and then himself. A portrait of the family stretches across the front page. Beside it, there's a small, blurred snapshot of the dog. All of them look ordinary, although neighbors say that the man had a temper, that the woman had been seen standing in the front window wearing her panties and bra. James reads the weather forecast. Snow, but not enough for a travel advisory. There's an article about a local high school coach whom James doesn't recognize. There's a letter to the editor about a boy just home from Vietnam. After finishing the paper, James wanders around the house, opening drawers and poking in closets. It is January, but there are still signs of Christmas. A half-eaten candy cane on his desk, its ends sucked to a sharp point. Used wrapping paper folded neatly on the counter, pressed flat under the Bible to wrap next year's gifts. A dying poinsettia on the windowsill, a gift to Ellen from the children, a gift she had liked. 1 week before Christmas, finishing up his last route of the year, James had stopped for coffee at a restaurant in a little town 100 miles from home. He cupped the chipped white mug between his hands, half listening to the conversations of the people at the tables around him. "Aunt Emma's so hard to buy for," a woman said, and he realized he didn't have a Christmas gift for Ellen. He paid for his coffee, then walked across the street to a small, shabby house with a sign hanging from the gutter that said, Naughty Maudie's Lingerie. A cardboard lady in a Santa Claus hat and a nightgown stood in the window. Think of her at Xmas was painted in block letters on the glass. The shop was in the front room, and it was cluttered with mannequin parts, hangers, balls of tissue paper, and piles of small cardboard boxes. Nightgowns hung in a row from the ceiling. James thought they looked nice. He reached up to pluck at a white lacy hem, wondering which one Ellen would like best. "That the one you want?" a woman said. She was sitting at a card table at the back of the room. Behind her, James could see down the hallway to the kitchen where several other women sat around a table piled with dirty pots and pans. They stared at him, and he looked away. Here he was not invisible. He could feel himself unraveling, becoming hesitant, unsure. "Yes," he said. "How much is this?" 20, the woman said. She got up, grabbed a box off a pile, and brought it over to James. "I got the identical thing in here," she said. When she handed it to him, she let her hip brush his. "Who's this for?" "For my wife," James said, "for Christmas." "You want I should model it for you?" the woman said. "Or maybe another girl?" She nodded to the women in the kitchen. James could smell her teeth. He shifted, not knowing what she wanted from him. She was laughing at him. Maybe he should turn around and go. "Do you gift wrap?" he asked. "Sorry," she said, and she stepped away. She took the box from James and stuffed it into a plastic bag. On Christmas Day, when Ellen opened the box, he realized he'd never checked the size. The nightgown was an extra large. Later in their bedroom, Ellen took off her clothes and picked up his hands and pressed them against her ribs. She guided him so they stood in front of the dresser mirror. James wished desperately to turn out the light. Her body, pressed against his own, was twisted and pale. "Don't you remember what I'm like?" she said. She moved his hands over her stomach and hips. "Does this feel like an extra large?" He kissed her, but as soon as she let go of his hands, he pulled them away. Her body wanted to swallow his body, her breath suck away his breath. Her warm weight would fill him like water, like blood, until he felt her pulse beating in his ears. James plucks the dying leaves in the poinsettia and throws them into the trash. He peeks out the kitchen window, then goes into the living room and stares out at the street. He sits down and tries to open the drawer to the coffee table, but the coffee table has been turned around so the little drawer opens toward the TV. He's certain it opened toward the couch the last time he was home. Inside the drawer, he finds expired coupons, rubber bands, and pens, a crumpled school paper of Amy's entitled A Rainy Day. Her handwriting is large and careful. Her apostrophes and periods are small hearts. "When it's rainy, I like to catch worms. I keep them in jars of dirt. If you cut a worm in half, one end will be a new worm, but the other end dies." He wonders if the new worm remembers the part that died. He thinks again of Amy's bruised cheek, how the bruise stands out on her pale, thin face. The thought of her being hurt, bruised, makes him queasy. He loves Amy, loves Bert. He cannot bear the thought of anything happening to either of them. Sometimes when he sees them watching TV or sleeping or playing quietly at some game, he imagines their frail skeletons beneath their skin and is seized by the sudden fear that they will die. One slight bump, one false step, the screech of a car or the thud of a falling tree branch. This is all it would take. If it happens, when it happens, he doesn't know what he will do. Better to choose the time, the method, yourself. Better to come home like the man from Milwaukee and get it all behind you once and for all, instead of waiting, helpless, for it to happen. The car, the branch, the illness, the closed casket. Better to break into your house with a gun, a violent lullaby. He goes into the children's room, paces between their beds. The mice watch, their eyes fixed and mean. He remembers the smell of the bedroom he shared with Mitch when they both were in their teens, a smell that was far more Mitch than James. Mitch's deodorant, Mitch's shirts, which he kept packed in cedar, Mitch's cologne, and at night, Mitch's onion sweat. The smell of Mitch when he was angry, the smell of Mitch when he turned mean, the smell of the sock, the smell of the barn, the weight of the grain. James lifts Bert's pillow to his face, sniffs the way one might sniff at food about to spoil. He sniffs Amy's pillow, a shirt left on the floor, the curtains. He sniffs the mice. Relief floods his mouth with wet. Nothing smells familiar. That night, he cannot eat. He sits at the table, passes the roast, the margarine and bread, the wrinkled peas. Across from him, at the head of the table, Fritz eats without looking up. Mary Margaret, already dressed for bed, takes sips and little bites, each time shaking her head, for Ellen has spread a white cloth across the table and lit the candles that stand by the fruit bowl in the center. Putting on airs. James can feel the way this thought travels back and forth between Fritz and Mary Margaret. The flames blink at him like hard watching eyes, Ellen's eyes flickering too close. He knows she's waiting for him to speak. She's gone through all this trouble for him because it's his last meal home for 2 weeks. The nice dinner, the candles, the white tablecloth, which she's told him is hard to clean. He should say something to her, to the children. But what? He watches the children, their small mouths opening and closing over their pointed teeth. It is 7 o'clock. At 8, there's a good movie, plenty of action, something set in the Old West. He forces himself to take a mouthful of peas. The frail skins pop against his tongue as he chews. He fights to swallow. He should say something. He checks his watch. 7:02. "So, what did you do today?" Ellen asks him. And for a moment, the children freeze, forks in the air, eyes on James's face. "What did Daddy do?" they are thinking. He knows they are thinking that. They are thinking he is dull, peculiar, unlike themselves and their mother. Fritz snorts, bites savagely into his bread. The movie starts at 8, a western, a good one. "I don't know," James says. "You don't know," Ellen says. "You must have done something." "Don't bother a man while he's eating," Mary Margaret says. Ellen ignores her, keeps her smile fixed on James. "I read the paper," James says. "Then you saw about that man, the man from Milwaukee? Barb told me about it at lunch." "What man?" Amy says. "A very sick man," Ellen says, and her voice shakes just slightly, but enough for him to think for the first time that perhaps she, too, looks at the children and is frightened by all the things that might happen, the cars and branches and caskets, that perhaps she, too, is afraid. He sees in her eyes a flicker, a flame, something he can almost recognize. "A very sick man," he says eagerly, but it comes out too loud, too strong, and she looks away. Mary Margaret wipes her lips. "This ain't proper table conversation," she says. "That's right," Ellen says quickly. "You should be eating. You should eat more." And she abruptly stands up and heaps his plate with peas and bread, roast, a pat of margarine, a piece of fruit from the fruit bowl. The children watch with round ghost eyes as she pushes him the salt and pepper. She gives him another piece of fruit. She fills his glass with milk. James fingers his knife and fork. There's something she wants from him, something he must do. "You should eat more," she had said. He drops his head and begins to eat. The roast, now the bread and margarine, the peas, the fruit. "Wonderful," he says. "I'm sorry," Ellen says quietly. She does not sit down. She's standing between the children. "I've given you too much." "Delicious," James says fiercely. He chokes down another bite of roast. He smiles at Ellen, smiles at his parents who are staring silent at his plate. He will eat everything. It will be his gift to them all. Knowing. Amy crouches outside her parents' bedroom with her ear pressed against the door. Inside, James sleeps fitfully. She can hear his breathing, rough as a cat scratching wood. The smell of his illness drifts through the house, clinging to the curtains, slithering along the walls. Pneumonia, bronchitis. Beautiful words like the names of dolls. Natalia, Clarissa, pleurisy. But Amy is almost 11, too old for dolls. On New Year's Day, she gave her own dolls funerals and buried them in cardboard boxes in her closet. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Now they are sleeping in the arms of God. "Where are Eliza and Missy?" Ellen asked when she tucked Amy into bed that night. Usually the dolls slept between Amy and the wall, their perfect heads propped up on the pillow. They looked sweet in the matching nightgowns that Ellen had sewn for them, yellow with lace stitched to the collars.
"They are dead," Amy said in the deep voice she had copied from Father Bork at school. "Do not speak of them again."
Now Amy imagines James's lungs like two pink mittens, swelling with air, rising up out of his chest, towing his soul to heaven. Dead people turn into guardian angels. Amy imagines James whispering advice into another girl's ear. "Wash your hands. Cheer up. Children should be seen and not heard."
Perhaps he would like being a guardian angel. Guardian angels get to travel all the time, and whenever James comes home, he is eager to get back on the road. When he leaves, Amy forgets about him quickly. When he's home, she thinks about him all the time. And this is the second week he's been homesick, lying in bed, struggling for air.
"Wash your hands. Don't chew with your mouth full. Turn out the goddamn lights."
Amy is certain Eliza and Missy have become her own guardian angels. Unlike James, they are practical angels with practical things to say. "Your grandmother hates you. Your dad's really weird. If you imagine something hard enough, you can make it come true."
Because of Eliza and Missy, Amy knows things other girls her age do not. Eliza and Missy give Amy special powers, magical powers, that warn her of the many secret and terrible things that are hidden in this world. Before Eliza and Missy, there was no one to look out for Amy, no one to protect her from those secret, terrible things. Last summer, she was walking in Autumn Lake because she had not yet learned to swim. The water was cool and tasted of iron. Ellen swam alongside her, graceful as a seal. "If you kick your feet, you'll float," she said. But Amy walked, step by cautious step, up to her hips, up to her waist, up to her chest, and then her foot came down on something soft. There were sharp knobs buried with it. Amy grabbed one of these knobs with her bare toes and pulled the thing to the surface. It was a drowned dog. The knobs were bones. The flesh was rotting, and it dissolved in oily pools on the surface of the water.
"Drop it!" Ellen shouted, and Amy kicked at it and screamed because she had never thought of a dog that way, as a thing made of bones and juices and skin. As Ellen guided her back to shore, Amy could see what the dog had been in life, a little terrier, white and brown, barking and circling and barking, just like Lassie always did when something was wrong.
"What is it, girl? What is it?"
The sound of James's breathing has stopped. Is he dead? Should she call her mother? Amy puts her hand on the doorknob and imagines James's long, narrow body sinking into muck, knobs for bones dissolving. When the doorknob twists beneath her hand, she jumps back, slamming herself hard against the wall. A man is standing in the doorway, clutching his bathrobe to his throat, his hair a rumpled halo. "Is he dead? Is he real?"
"What do you want?" the man says sharply. "How come you're pestering me again?"
Amy runs down the hall to the room she shares with Bert. She slams the door, gets in the closet, and hides behind her dresses. It was here that Ellen found the cardboard boxes that held the bodies of Eliza and Missy. On the cover of each box, a cross was drawn in heavy black magic marker. R.I.P. 1967-1972. The eyes of the dolls were taped closed.
"They are deceased," Amy had said in Father Bork's deep voice. "Do not disturb their rest."
Ellen sat down on the floor of the closet with the shoes. Her shoulders moved up and down.
"You're just a little girl," she said. And she stroked the matching nightgowns the dolls wore, smoothing the rumpled lace. "What is happening to you?"
That day at Autumn Lake, Amy had been furious with Ellen, a wild, helpless fury that left her shaking and cold. "Why didn't you tell me it was there?" she said as the other children and their families stared. "Why did you let me step on it?"
"I didn't know," Ellen said.
"Yes, you did. Yes, you did," said Amy. But now she is older and she knows better. When her mother explains, she nods and waits.
"You didn't know," she agrees.
At supper time, Amy comes out of the bedroom to help Ellen fix the meal. The kitchen is dimly lit, close, smelling of grease. Tiny yellow flowers watch from the curtains. Yellow eyes, patient, like the waiting eyes of dogs.
"Hey, Mom," Amy says, "what are we having?"
"Meatballs and rice," Ellen says. "Set the table and fix up some jello for dessert." Amy chooses lime jello. careful with the boiling water, and then set six places. Fritz at one end of the table, James at the other, Mary Margaret to James's right, Ellen to James's left, Bert between Fritz and Mary Margaret, and her own place beside her mother. Napkins, salt and pepper, a serving spoon for the meatballs. In the living room, Mary Margaret is playing the piano and Fritz is watching TV. Fritz turns up the TV volume. Mary Margaret begins to sing. "So much for your father getting any rest," Ellen says. "I don't know why he's getting better between their noise and you pestering him all the time."
"He pesters me," Amy says.
"That's not what I'm told.
It's weird having him here."
"Wouldn't it be nice if he could be here all the time? If he could find a job close to home?" Amy knows Ellen wants her to say how it would be nice.
"It would be weird," Amy says. "Maybe we could move into a place of our own, like in Illinois. You remember Illinois?"
"That would be okay," Amy says. Although what she remembers best about her father in Illinois is him sending her from the table whenever she picked up her fork incorrectly. "You don't want to grow up like a hick," he said. Or, "There's a right way to do everything."
"Wasn't it nice then, spending time with Daddy when he came home from his trips?"
He liked Amy and Bert to sit side by side on the couch, doing nothing, saying nothing. Then he'd stare past them as if they weren't even there. Once he pulled an envelope out of his desk and showed them how much it had cost for each of them to be born.
"It was okay," Amy says.
"You didn't know. You didn't know." At school, beautiful Sister Justina tells them to start a journal. When Sister Justina talks, her hands shape the air into pictures for everyone to see. Her voice is something Amy can taste, something so good she can never have enough. All the girls in Amy's class want to enter convents when they grow up and wear the lovely deep blue Sister Justina wears and speak in Sister Justina's delicious voice. "What should we write in it?" someone asks.
"Thoughts, wishes, hopes, dreams," Sister Justina says,
her hands sweep together, collecting and polishing the words.
"Things that have happened, things that you want to happen, anything you like. Take 15 minutes now to begin."
Amy writes "journal" on the cover of her notebook, then opens it and stares at the first blank page. "I have nothing to say," she writes. "My dad is homesick, but he is better. Soon he can go back to work. I want to have a cat, but he says no because of fleas. I have a brother. He is 6. When Sister Justina bends over Amy's shoulder, her dark blue habit sweeps Amy's cheek.
"Was your father very sick?" she asks.
Amy nods, blissful, too shy to speak. At recess, the girls cluster by the fire hydrant, pretending to smoke cigarettes, exhaling puffs of warm air into the cold